This episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. Backup your PC or Mac off-site securely and automatically. For a free trial offer plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com. Offer code TWIM. This week on the show, DSLRs are in the house, Apple begins its assault on TV, and streaking at the streamies, right here on This Week in Media, number 180. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex Lindsay sitting in for Daisy, who is at Ad Tech. So she is down there, I'm sure, talking up a storm. That's what Daisy does. And but she wasn't unable to come to us and be with us here at the studio. But we do have Tim in the studio.
This is my first time here. Thanks for having me.
Is this the first time you've ever been here?
This is the first time I've ever been here. I love it. It's great.
It's good to have you.
Petaluma's a cute little town.
Petaluma is really nice.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
I'm supposed to be at Ad Tech, but I snuck out to come up here.
And it was worth it, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, Petaluma really grows on you.
Yeah.
So
I'm ready to move in. I saw Andy and Opie and the whole gang.
Well, what's great about Petaluma is that it's a mixture of being that has that little bit of a farm town kind of feel, but it's mixed with this kind of art and tech stuff that goes on. It's very, very unique.
I was surprised that there weren't a lot of boarded up stores, because you go to a lot of small towns in America and everything's boarded up, but here it's local stores that seem to be thriving.
There was a little bit on Main Street, but it's definitely recovering. So it's done pretty well. Also on the line, we've got Brian Stelter from New York Times. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm pretty good.
And someday we're going to have you come hang out in Petaluma with us.
I would love to. I'm curious about what goes on over there.
It's the infamous Petaluma. So before we go any further, we got a lot of great stories coming up here. But before we go any further, we want to thank our sponsor, Carbonite. Of course, Carbonite is one of the leader for online backup. So the thing is that we always say within the office that nothing's safe unless it's in, nothing exists until it exists in two places, and it's really important. And the big thing is that if it exists in two places and it's both of them are in your office, it doesn't really help. The problem that you get into is that you got to have a copy somewhere outside of your office. Now, some of us can try to figure out a way to have it at our friend's house or our parents' house or something, and then bring drives back and forth and all this stuff, but. Or you could get something that's in the cloud, and that's what Carbonite does. So you can take the most important images, your kids, your business PR photos, your most important documents, and get them out off-site. That off-site, the files are secure. They're now safe from theft, fires, floods, disasters, so on and so forth. You can manage it with an encryption key if you want. And it's also affordable. It's $5 a month. It's kind of insurance against losing your media. I know that the thing that I worry about when I think of someone breaking in, don't worry about the machines at all. Don't worry about the television. I mean, it would be a bummer. But what I'm really worried about is the fact that now the things that are the most important to me, these photos of my kids and everything else, are in something that is actually valuable. Like when people used to break into your house, they wouldn't try to steal your photos. Like they didn't mean anything. But now those photos are sitting in a computer that they most likely would grab onto. So it's really something that is worth doing, especially to keep all of those things that are the most important to you in check and safe somewhere off-site. So definitely check it out. It's Carbonite. You can try Carbonite for free. That's right, for free. If you go up to carbonite.com and enter the offer code TWIM. Of course, that's TWIM. That's us. And you definitely want to check it out. So if you are... If you're thinking about this, if you're thinking about getting into the cloud and making sure that your most important photos and documents are safe, try out carbonite.com and once again, enter the offer code TWIM. And if you decide after to buy the service, you'll get 2 months free with that same offer code of TWIM. So, sign up for the free trial and you'll get in the homepage to get the 2 months for free. And that's carbonite.com, offer code TWIM. So... into the stories. First story, we talked about this on This Week in Photography, but we're going to talk about it here at a whole different angle. This is the Canon 5D Mark II. Now, for those of you on TWIP, we can just say, well, that's what that is. for those of you who don't, the Canon 5D Mark II, of course, is a still camera. It is a digital still camera, and it has kind of rolled into the filmmaking market. There's a whole cottage industry that has been kind of built around supporting this little still camera, and you're starting to see it show up in all these different places. Well, where it showed up, you know, recently is shooting the entire House season finale, on a still camera. So normally these are big film cameras; they're very expensive, and they're shooting the whole thing on a 5D. Tim, what do you think of this?
I think it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's fun to see the technology that we've been using in web video migrate towards television and film, yeah, rather than the other way around.
Right.
And to imagine that, you know, they're shooting, what is it, a $2,000 camera?
Yeah. I mean, $3,000, $2,700.
Yeah.
And so, they're probably wrapping the Steadicam that sits around it is probably worth more than the camera.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And to be able to shoot with that, I mean, there are some issues and you have to treat it a little bit differently, but it opens up a whole new world for filmmakers to create something that has this super high quality at such a low cost. I mean, I'm really excited about it. It was fun at NAB to see people going around shooting stuff,
right,
and everyone had their camera tricked out a different way because they don't, like...
The trick out of the DSLR is totally like buying a Honda Civic and like putting on spoilers and all
the
stuff.
It's more like those days of the 1950s where they would soup up their car, you know, because everybody's got, it's different. They have this rail or this eyepiece or this battery pack.
Why did you pick that follow focus?
And everybody's checking each other out too. It's all like this jockeying that's going on. Oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. Brian, what's the business model? Why do you shoot a huge film? The show probably costs $2 or $3 million an episode. Why do you shoot it on a DSLR?
Well, for those in the television industry that constantly try to trim budgets back further and further, any development like this is a big deal. Any way they can further reduce costs on these shows is a big deal, because they're getting squeezed. Even shows like House that are hugely popular are getting squeezed by their networks and their studios every season. I doubt they'll shoot every episode this way, but as a proof of concept, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I guess you can get into spaces that are a little bit smaller. I think that, you know, the percentage of cost for the camera is very, very small. It's almost insignificant compared to the cost of the actors and everything else. But it definitely, you know, I think it probably speeds up the production, which of course saves a lot of money too, because it's a smaller camera. It's easier to move around, and so it's anyway, it's very interesting. We'll see how that goes. Go ahead.
I was reading some of the exchanges among the cameramen on Twitter, and one of the points is that it brings the actors' faces more into the foreground and brings the actors closer to the viewers.
Right.
You know, those sorts of changes are subtle, but they're powerful, I think. And it's nice to think about how can the viewer actually be helped, or how does it actually help the program to shoot it this way? Maybe we'll see other shows try it also.
Fantastic. It's going to be very interesting to see how that turns out. Also, this is the Streamy Awards. Of course, Tim, you were at the Streamy Awards.
I was at the Streamy Awards.
So how was it?
It was great. It was a really good show.
Right.
It's a lot of fun.
There were some people that were that said that it didn't turn out the way that they had expected.
Well, yeah, there were some technical difficulties, and that led to some ad libs that weren't very family friendly, should I say. And
so catch people up if they sure hadn't seen the Streamy. What were the technical limits?
Well, Vanity Fair calls the Streamy Awards the Oscars for web video. And the first year they did it last year, it was a fairly sizable performance that was put on, but there weren't any fancy dance numbers or anything like that. This year, and last year went off pretty much without a hitch. Although I was the only presenter last year that didn't receive a gift bag, so I'm still holding a grudge on that one.
He's bitter.
Yeah, not that I'm bitter, but they asked me 15 minutes before the show to present something, so I'm okay. But this year, they tried to take it up a notch, up to maybe three notches. And, people are upset with what happened at the awards. I mean, there were technical difficulties. There were times where people were ad-libbing with inappropriate material. Lots of jokes about a certain part of the male body that was not very well accepted. And then there were security issues with people running up on stage doing Kanye West type things. And
this was during one, this was all brought about by some of the technical difficulties.
Not all of it, but okay. You know.
Now, what were the technical difficulties?
Just teleprompters not working, oh, right. Different, you know, audio problems, normal technical issues, and then probably the highlight of the night for bad things was when two streakers ran up on stage.
Mm.
But
and of course, all of this is streaming live.
It's all streaming live, and so yeah. You know, a lot of people were upset about it. But I mean, my feeling is that kind of stuff happens, right. And I think we should. You know, give the guys at Tube Filter a pass because they do a great job and they really helped our community. And
well,
yeah,
Brady's been on the show.
Yeah,
Brady's one of our show friends. And the thing is that it is something that is a challenge anytime you're doing something live. And the hard part is that it's also hard, to, especially when you're moving. I think this is one of the challenges you get into where you're moving from the web to a more broadcast feel.
Yeah.
And the issue is you don't understand why everyone spends so much money on all that stuff. Until you try to kind of cobble it together and turn out, it would have been nice to have a little bit extra.
Yeah, I think they've learned their lesson. I think, you know, there will be a next year. I think they're going to do a fantastic job next year. And I don't see it as an issue. It's, you know what, if you have kids make mistakes. And this is one of those, you know, child mistakes. It's only the second year of doing it.
We broadcasted for an hour and a half from NAB live, except it wasn't really broadcasting. So you know, that's what happens. I mean, it's all new technology. A lot of this stuff is.
Yeah, I heard you had some security issues too.
Well, it wasn't technical. It was we wandered into. So we've been shooting at parties. So NAB, we had a live view box. So for those of you listening, a live view is it's a box with six EVDO modems.
And it's a backpack, right?
Yeah, and Leo
so
used
people,
it.
People don't know. They don't know that it's a. They don't recognize that it's live.
Like, to us, it's obvious. There's like a big backpack. You look like a spaceship, but it's not. You know, and so what happened was that we've been shooting at lots of parties, and we had a kind of a false start at one of them on Monday or Tuesday, and then we finally got it all working. And by the time the red user group,
I walk in the door, you guys are shooting me as soon as I walk in.
I was like, and you could see that we weren't really hiding it. I mean, we had a light, we had a, you know, cameras, we were pushing people away, we were like doing our whole thing, and we hadn't asked anybody, but every party we were at had people had said, "Oh, this is great!" And so we just figured, well, you know, if they let us through security, they must be fine with it. And so we just wandered in and started shooting, and we shot for about 40 minutes. And then what happened was that we got up near where the founder was, you know, showing off the Epic and talking to folks, anyway, so suddenly security got a little tighter about the whole process, and we were pulled aside, and they said, "Well, you know, you're not supposed to be shooting here." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, no one, you know, we just walked in with all the stuff. We didn't think anything of it." And he goes, "I'm afraid we're gonna have to take your tape." And I was like, "Well, the tape is the internet. You know, like we've been streaming live.
We don't need no stinking tapes."
And then there's a lot of confusion. Like people are just kind of like, you know, and then Ted Shilowitz, who you know, runs a lot of what Red does.
Yeah, he's the guy. He's the evangelist. He's employee number one.
Yeah, and so Ted brought us outside and said, you know, we're gonna have to destroy. He didn't hit the message hadn't gotten through the grapevine. He's like, we're gonna have to take the tape, and you know, this is really for users. And his point was valid. You know, it's a user event. We don't want it to become a press event because everyone wants to be part of the Red, you know, revolution. And we did. That's why we showed up. And so he was really great about it. He said, we are going to have to take the tape. And I was like, yeah, there's no tape. Like, it was live. And then Ted had that kind of like, oh, you know, what am I going to do now? And so what he did, which was fantastic after that, which was that he went in and grabbed an Epic, and we went into another room, and we sat there and had a, you know, 20-minute conversation about the Epic. And
that's,
you know,
what Ted does. He just talks.
He did, and he was so great about it. And so it was it turned out to be good for us, and I think good. I mean, a lot of the people watching live, there are 400 people watching. It wasn't a huge audience, but everyone watching live really was impressed with the way Ted, you know, kind of managed what was at the moment a little bit of a glitch. And so I think it did well for everyone anyway. But that's what we did but the whole thing is that when it's live, it's a whole different world, and it's this whole different crazy point. Now, to get to Brian, from the Streamy Awards, do you think that this is something that's easy to recover from? Is it something that they're just going to come back next year with a completely different format? Does it lessen the importance of the Streamies at all?
I haven't followed this scandal very closely. So okay. for people like me, doesn't have a long term effect. I've got to think that for attendees. Yeah. For attendees, it might have a bigger effect, but they've got bigger problems. They have to focus on becoming a bigger, broader, more mainstream event. I would think that's what every award show like this wants to do. So I would think that it's easier to recover because they're trying to reach a bigger audience every year.
Right, and they're just getting started.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's easy for us to think that this is really, really important, but it's not like they had millions and millions and millions of viewers.
It's not like that many people outside of the community know what the Streamies are.
And the people in the community understand what's going on. Yeah. They understand.
There were people inside the community that were upset about what was going on. The funny thing is there were people from traditional media that didn't take it so hard. Right. So you would think it's ironic. You would think it'd be the other way around.
Because it wasn't as important to them.
I guess so.
So it'll be interesting to see. I think it'll be great. I can't wait. Hopefully, maybe he'll call us. We'll help him. We're doing lots of streaming now.
There you go.
So, but it is hard. We've started doing a lot of event streaming, live event streaming, and you are stressed about someone doing something goofy and there's no way to stop it. And so we have a bunch of little systems kind of built in place to make sure that doesn't, minimize the chance of that happening. There's a couple seconds between, it's that typical 7 second, there's a couple seconds between, when we see it and when it ends up somewhere that we can kind of make adjustments if we have to. So, next story, Apple goes where portals have failed. It's hardware stupid. And this is from Wired magazine. So it said, this is from Fred Vogelstein said 6 months ago, an Apple analyst told him that he thought that the company's long-term goal was to become the internet's cable TV company. And he said he didn't get it now, but he really gets it now. And the idea is, didn't get it then, but gets it now. The idea is that the money is still coming from selling the hardware, but they are, we're seeing Apple move towards advertising, towards distribution. Brian, do you think this is, do you think Apple has a chance to become the internet cable's TV company?
Well, once I got an iPad, I understood why they were trying so hard to get a subscription TV service in place before the iPad came out. The iPad is kind of worthless for video right now. It's hard to say that. It's hurtful to say that. I wish it wasn't worthless for video right now. But except for ABC shows and web video shows and shows you're willing to pay for through iTunes, there isn't enough there for me to recommend an iPad to someone that wants to watch television on it. So I can understand why they would want to be that cable model. I understand why they were, really trying to persuade television networks to get on board with a subscription service. But the fact that none of the networks showed real interest in doing so, at least not yet, is showing how hard a road this is going to be for Apple. There's a lot of people that are invested in the status quo here, and I think Apple's going to find that to be an extremely hard slog going forward.
Well, do we think that Apple, I mean, a lot of these companies, do you think that they're afraid of Apple, afraid of letting Apple have too much in this area?
I think there's an element of maintaining the status quo in many different ways, and that can affect Apple. Let's take NBC, for instance, and their decision about the iPad. They give away shows on the iPhone. They let you stream for free on the iPhone, but they didn't let you stream on the iPad because they'd rather experiment and make you pay for it through the iTunes Store. Well, so far, I have a feeling not many people are paying through the iTunes Store. We'll see if their decision changes. But, that kind of mentality that they're going to be restrictive, that they're going to force you to pay or try to get you to pay in that case. I think there's those kinds of entrenched attitudes that Apple's up against in this case. Doesn't mean it won't work in 5 years, but
right.
The fact that they haven't made any evident progress so far is telling. And I've been told from every network that I talk to that they're not going to rule out the Apple subscription package, but there's nothing imminent happening there.
Well, and I think that a lot of people are trying to change the business model. They're looking at the iPad being released as an opportunity to try to reset the system, not give everything away, not have everything be free. The web is free. TV has been largely free. And the issue is that they're trying to figure out, can we start, whether it's a magazine or a newspaper or a TV station, they're trying to figure out how do we turn this into a revenue generating thing before our current box disappears. I mean, would you agree?
I totally agree with that, and I think in some ways, for instance, magazines, I'm thrilled to have a new way to pay for content. I'm thrilled to have this new way, this new business model forming. That is, if the magazines ever get on the iPad and get their act together. I think for the TV networks, though, the Americans watch 150 hours of television every month. They watch an average of 5 hours a day of television. So to expect that to move on to tablets anytime soon is a real stretch. Apple can try to make a dent in it with the iTunes Store, but I think that this is going to be an extremely hard road for them.
Well, and here's the question I have, though, is that, and this is for you, Tim, is that the that is the case where there's a lot of people watching TV. But one of the arguments is that, that I've made and other people have made is that when you look at the people who are buying iPads and when you're looking at people who buy iPhones, one of the things that it, that becomes clear is they are the top of the food chain when it comes to consumers. These guys are, these men and women, boys and girls, are the ones that are willing to spend a lot of money on stuff because it's fun, because it's interesting, because they're willing to do that. And so the thing is that one argument that I saw online was that there is a taking all of these people, if the iPad, let's say, sells 20 or 30 million copies over the next 3 or 4 years, and having all the iPhone users and everything else, it's kind of like taking all the healthy people out of the healthcare system. You know, is that, you know, suddenly all these people, you know, is that all these people who are making, who make a lot, you know, have a lot of disposable income, evidently, who are willing to spend it on gadgets, you start pulling them all out when you look at what Apple's doing with iAd, when you're looking at all the iAd, you know, and all this other stuff. It's taking out a very, very valuable, they're basically taking the best consumers out of the market and letting everybody else have the rest of the market, and which devalues the entire process. Tim, do you think that's a valid concern for anyone?
No, not at all. I wouldn't worry about it one way or the other because, I mean, take a look at MP3 players, right? When MP3 players first came out, you know, they were these little small things that cost a lot of money, and some of them were cheap. Some of them were expensive, but Apple didn't make a dent in that. They didn't create anything that would play MP3s that everybody had have.
I mean,
it's the same thing.
The non iPod MP3 market is thriving.
Yeah, it's the same thing. So to poo-poo the iPad, I think is the same thing as people were poo-pooing the iPod. So history will repeat itself.
So you think that this is a big
I think impact. It's a huge shift, and to be saying, oh well, there's no TV on it. I mean, Brian, I love you, man, but how many weeks has it been since this thing has been out?
I agree. I'm saying it for right now. Now it's crippled.
You look at television. It was 25 years from the time that a television program first aired until there was a regularly scheduled sponsored show. 25 years. It took that long. So I think it's going to happen a little bit faster here. But I think we're going to see TV on more than – I mean, the ABC app is pretty cool. We're going to see more apps like that. There are companies out there working on dynamic ad insertion for video and having that in-stream video play. You know, one of my sponsors is doing it. I think we're going to see more and more, and we're going to see new types of programming that haven't existed. You know, right. I mean, you think about the iPad. I mean, I'm sorry, the iPod and the simplistic games that were on those first iPods. You know, the black and white iPods. Those games were nothing, right? They were like Pong. But now you look at an iPhone and an iPod Touch and the sophisticated games that are on the iPad. It's changed immensely in 5 years.
I mean, when you look at the race.
What I'm saying, though, is that the billionaires that run the cable and satellite companies are not going to allow, or they're going to die trying not to allow a company like Apple to come in here and disrupt the market to that effect. If we have video on the iPad, if we have every network on the iPad in 2 years, I think it might be through Comcast or through Time Warner Cable. And that'll be nice. I'd like that. I'm totally bullish on tablets. I just think right now these devices, I returned the one I bought for my mom today. Because without Flash, for instance, there's simply no point to give her that iPad. A year from now, there will be a point, and I will get one. I'll probably tell my brothers to buy them too. A couple of years from now, I'm bullish on tablets, but I'm bearish on the idea that Apple's going to be able to disrupt this entire television industry.
Well, I think they're going to try to stop it because, I mean, the issue that you end up with is an Apple sitting potentially on a vertical market. You know, they have all the content creation tools sitting over on one side, whether it's amateur or professional.
The developers conference is going to be really interesting to see. There's no announcement yet. Like, we don't know a date yet. This is pretty late for not knowing.
Yeah. Although we do know the date. It's the last week of June.
But nothing's
there's an Apple event. There's a mysterious Apple event booked at the Moscone Center the last week of June. So we know when it is. It's just when Apple's going to turn the pipe on.
Yeah.
You know, and let everyone sign up and buy their tickets. And most likely it'll have to happen in the next couple of weeks because people have to have time to buy tickets, especially if they're trying to fly through Europe. Yeah, exactly. So the but the issue is that I always, you know, feel like Apple's nuke that they're sitting on is always, you know, if you won't publish, you know, I'm waiting for iMovie or Final Cut or DVD Studio Pro to just have published to iTunes. You know, like the, you know, yeah. you know that's the thing is like no one's ever said
but
that
Garage
at Apple.
Band
no
does. I mean, but it but not, GarageBand not, it, but, not in a monetary way.
Yeah, but the thing is that Apple is like one menu item away from cutting out the entire all the middlemen. You know, in that process, and I don't think they're never gonna do that when they, as long as people keep on playing. The big thing is that if they don't have anything to lose, if they're not getting forward momentum, and they want to, you know, turn that pipe a little harder. And I don't think that Steve Jobs really likes the media industry. I mean, he likes working with it. He likes the cool factor and everything else. I think it would be one of those things that someone else, if Steve Jobs wasn't there, someone else would just walk in and go, oh, let's just flick the switch, you know, and that would really create a revolution that I don't think anyone in the media industry would necessarily be looking forward to. But anyway, so also in the news, speaking of opening stuff up, Google TV, Google is now, it's another reason open sourcing for VP8 matters, and this is Google's decision to open source Onto Technologies VP8 video codec at its Google I/O developer conference next month is not only a huge boom for HTML5 web video, but a blow against Adobe's Flash. This is according to Janko Reuters at New TV.
He's a nice guy. I like Janko.
Yeah. So, Tim, does VP8 matter?
I think it does. I think, you know, you say people are scared of Apple. I think they're way more scared of Google. So this will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, this is our own real Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. And it also seems to be another attack at Adobe.
Well, it seems like all of these guys are all kind of, whether it's the, you know, the you have Google and Adobe and Amazon and Apple all kind of jockeying for position. I do think it's funny we don't talk about Microsoft that much as far as jockeying for that position.
Well, they haven't released the Windows phone yet. We're waiting on that. That'll be as big as the Zoom, maybe bigger.
You are just full of the sarcasm today. So, Brian, do you think that that VP8 matters in this market?
It makes sense to me that it would. I'm not an expert on it though, unfortunately.
Right. No, fine. Yeah, I think that the thing is that you have H.264 requires, you know, more processing speed, but it also looks nicer. So you got to decide, you know, the reason it requires more processing speed is because it's doing more work. It's figuring out a more intelligent way of making that for the for the same visual quality, an H.264 file is a lot smaller. Now, VP8, you can make it look as nice as H.264. It just has to be a lot bigger. So, and Google may not care anymore that it's bigger. I mean, they're only, you know, it's whatever, $100 million a month that they're spending on bandwidth. Who cares, you know? And so maybe that doesn't matter. But it does mean that when you're, the VP8 does make it easier. Now, the other thing that may be happening with the H.264 is that one of the pieces of fine print that always, the people talk about every once in a while is that in 2014, the amnesty of charging royalties for H.264 is, you know, ends. And theoretically, Google could, I mean, not Google, the MPEG committee could theoretically begin to charge royalties for the use of H.264. The rumor is that's one of the reasons that you're limited in YouTube to 10-minute clips, because it is, I think it's either 10 or 12 minutes is the limit. So anything under that is not something that MPEG, you know, it's under the license. And there's a certain number of viewers and also a certain length. But if you go longer than that, they can theoretically do that. So some people, whether it's Firefox, you know, wanting to have Ogg Vorbis or Google open sourcing VP8 is, you know, all of these things of trying to kind of work around, you know, some of those issues. And do we think any of this has to do with Apple? Where Google's, you know, Apple has obviously committed to H.264. Tim, do you think that anyone has, you think this is any kind of push towards that?
I mean, there's a war going on, you know, right. And they're frenemies though. I mean, they do stuff together. They do stuff apart, you know, with Eric leaving the Apple board, clear path there as to there are lines being drawn.
It's an exciting, Does it seem like it's just an exciting time to be watching the media industry?
It's an exciting time to be playing with all this stuff. I mean, you think back to when you were a kid and you were watching right. Star Trek and being able to do almost everything that we saw on the show.
Yeah. I mean, Brian, does it seem like there's a lot more happening right now? It just seems like we're in this weird mix of, you know, from the Chinese curse kind of, you know, may you live in exciting times.
I think the nice thing about both Google and Apple and the effect of both of these companies in the media space is that they push innovation toward everybody else. We were talking about the cable and satellite companies earlier. These companies have to be pushed to jump forward, to innovate in this way, to bring people content on more platforms. And Google and Apple are both, they're both lighting a fire, I think. The Google TV platform, again, I'm pretty skeptical about these things because I think there's a lot of entrenched interests. But Google trying to get into this television area as well is just another, you know, fire lit under these cable and satellite companies and these providers to give them reason to innovate. So it is exciting.
I mean, in some ways, you wish that Google and Apple got along better, because when you're looking at a gigabit internet connection at cities with an iPad wirelessly, you know, it does seem like, why would I ever think about, you know, watching TV again?
Yeah, there are definitely things that we've, as consumers, are being cheated out of. You know, we know it can do it. We're just not allowed to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And some of us know we can do it, and we are doing it. And this is according to Yahoo, nearly 800,000 U.S. TV households cut the cord.
Yeah, they call it the Daisy Whitney effect.
You know, it really is the Daisy Whitney effect. This is the fact. Daisy has officially cut her cord almost a year ago, or more than a year ago. And everyone's like, well, if Daisy can do it.
Yep.
They all knew that she was pretty much an addict when it comes to watching TV, and now she's moved on. She's past it. Brian, we keep on talking about the big industry, but you know, and the big guys. Is this a trend that they should worry about?
I think they do worry about it, but I think on the other hand, we're going through a renaissance right now in the quality of television. This month, and I hope nobody listens to this and then runs off and writes about it, because I want to write about this in the next couple of weeks, but we just hit the 50% mark for HD penetration. So half the country is watching in high definition on their television sets, and 3D allegedly is right around the corner. So given, you know, on the one hand, we have people cutting the cord. I think we've always had that. We'll always have that. What we have to look for is whether the number of people doing that increases. This report says it'll double this year to 1.6 million. But there's 100 million households watching TV in the country. So the cable companies do indicate that they are watching this and they're aware of it. But at the same time, they are, even though we kind of hate them, we always hate our cable company, they are delivering a pretty impressive product now into more and more houses. It helps them, I think, stem the losses.
Now, is there a concern on their part that this will move faster than they're able to figure out a new business model?
I haven't picked up on that in my conversations. There's been a couple of times where Time Warner Cable, I think the CEO of Time Warner Cable, has said that, you know, they're seeing cord cutting happening in a way they haven't before. But I don't sense I don't sense an urgency right. among these cable and satellite companies to address it.
They still have 100 million people.
Right, and there's all these little things they're trying that hopefully will trickle down to consumers. For instance, Cablevision saying they're going to make it really, really easy to port your computer screen to your TV set, like with a click of a button. Basically, your computer screen will become a channel on your TV, so you'll be able to watch, you know, without any kind of wires or anything needed. Stuff like that's pretty impressive. If they can keep pulling off those sorts of innovations, I think they will stem their losses from cord cutting.
Tim, do you see yourself cutting the cord anytime soon?
I want to, but I keep holding on. They're just, you know, event programming is one thing.
Right.
You know, and I love TiVo. You know, TiVo is just great. I just love that it's there, that I can navigate it. If I could get programming through TiVo without having cable, I'd get rid of cable.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I'm so disconnected. I don't know these days. I don't know what channel.
No clue. If it's on TiVo, I watch it.
Yeah. My wife and I were talking about, like, there was something we were trying to watch and we couldn't find it on you know, Comcast On Demand or whatever. And we were like, what network's on it? I have no idea. I have no idea what time it shows up. I have no idea what network it is. It was the...
Yeah. I think we're going to see some search-based stuff popping into the market.
Well, Google's working on that, right? That's the set-top box.
Google's working on it. There's an Israeli company called BTV mm-hmm. that's working on it, and a few others. And they're not only working on it from a search, they're also working on it from a recommendation. I mean, Boxy's kind of in the same space, but it's still tough to, you know, type on your remote control. And I think that's a huge opportunity with the iPad. Imagine searching for shows you want on the iPad,
right.
hitting the button, and they pop on your TV.
Now, also connected to this whole disconnect, Netflix agrees to a 28-day delay for Fox Universal movies and TV shows. So Netflix, this is according to the San Jose Mercury News, Frank Mee, and he said that, is now, you know, the catch that they're getting a lot more stuff from Fox and Universal for their instant streaming service. So this is not for the DVDs. This is for the streaming service. They have to wait 28 days after the DVD street date, giving the studios time to rake in the receipts from sales directly to consumers before they're available on Netflix. So here's the question is, do you keep track of when release dates are for DVDs?
Absolutely. I mark it on my calendar. I'm trying to think.
There he goes again.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last time I got my hands on a DVD. You know, I mean, I have Netflix, but I'm watching the streaming stuff on Netflix. I very rarely do I pop a DVD in and watch a DVD.
I'm
anymore.
Just resentful of plastic.
And the point is that when we have streaming, even when we have, I just signed up for Netflix streaming last week. I'm a late adopter, but the iPad convinced me to do it. And I would never notice when a new movie. I would never notice the 28-day delay. There's right. I don't think we think about our movies the way we think about TV shows in that way. And even though they're doing this, on the other hand, we're seeing movie studios release DVDs sooner than ever. So it actually might be a negligible difference over the long term.
Yeah, it seems like maybe Netflix knows something that Fox doesn't know or hasn't realized, which is that no one really cares. They're like, sure, yeah, you can have that. It's almost like a red herring. Sure, and we'll give you 28 days.
You know what? It's not really the movie studios that are making the noise. It's the theater owners that are making the noise about this, and that's mm-hmm. why they want that window there. I mean, the studios would like it to be day and date so that they spend all the marketing money and get the bang everywhere. Right. But they have to placate those theater owners.
Who are going crazy. I mean, they're terrified, right?
But they like 3D.
They do.
They do. They're making more money.
You know, just one technical note about the 3D stuff is that I realize that when we don't think that 3D is very good, we're not seeing good 3D. So the reason I say that is that there have been now two experiences that I've had that have been better than Avatar from cheap cameras. Mm. From cheap cameras. One was the first time I saw a video shot by the Fuji. You know, their little, I think it's called the S1 or the SJ1 or whatever. They have a little $600 camera. And I saw that video, and it was just like, wow, this is amazing. And it was suddenly way better than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And then when I was on the floor at NAB,
yeah.
you know, Panasonic has the new 3D right. camera with right. two lenses. And there's something about – so what's happening a lot of times is – and we're about to do a 3D test shoot on Thursday at Kerner Optical. And – but what happens is, and I think we'll do it really well there, but a lot of times you're taking two cameras and you're going through a mirror and you're doing, you know, there's all this stuff that you're doing to try to get these two cameras to line up, these big cameras. And there's something about two lenses that are in the same camera that are totally built to work with each other, that are totally calibrated, that gives you a incredibly 3D experience. Like when I look through when I put the glasses on, and did you put them on at NAB?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It was gorgeous. I was like, oh, okay, this is the future.
The other really good 3D experience I had at NAB was GoPro. Did you see GoPro?
I didn't see them using it. Did they have a stereo pack?
They had a stereo pack. They had two little ones. And while I was looking at those cameras, Vegas Showgirl came by, gave me a neck and shoulder massage. That was awesome. That was...
See, there he goes. He's just Tim's in a mood.
I am.
So anyway, I'll
be here all week.
Yeah, exactly. What were we gonna say, Brian?
I finally watched live 3D sports a couple weeks ago with the NCAA finals, and I found myself thinking, you know, because you have to have different camera angles for these live sporting events, I found myself thinking what I really want at home on my TV set, on my 3D set, is to be able to change the camera at my leisure. I want to be able to, you know, pick my own camera angles the way you do in a video game, because it is a video game experience in a way. And I wonder, you know, that's probably 10 years down the road, but the ability to both have 3D and to pick the camera angle would be phenomenal. And I'd probably watch more sports.
And I think
crossing my fingers for that.
And I think Fox has been actually experimenting with some of that, with some of their flash coverage of the NFL. Is that there have been some where they were like showing you lots of camera angles, and you could actually click on which one you're actually able to watch. They're definitely trying to figure out. Of course, the issue there is bandwidth. You know, is trying to get all that stuff to kind of to sort out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun novelty. I'll be interested to see how long term that plays out.
You know, as I said, when you see, and this was the big thing about Clap. We talked about this in the last week's Twim. Is the big problem is when bad 3D comes out, like Clash of the Titans, you wonder why this is a fad. This doesn't make any sense. Why bother? And when you see really good 3D, you're like, oh, right. It really works. It's much more immersive. It's much more interesting. So I think it's good versus bad. Last story of the day. And I know that we're kind of and Brian, I'm going to let you give your last 2 cents, and then I know you need to be back at the desk at New York Times. Walmart making family friendly movies. So Walmart is actually this is according to Hulick. I think is making a family friendly franchise into the music making business. So they're actually going to debut their first movie, or came out last Friday, and then they're going to have the DVDs. Of course, Walmart, they're going to have the DVDs released the following day. Is this something that do we think we're going to see more of this, Brian? I'm going to let you.
For Procter & Gamble, it makes total sense, and since they were the ones that basically invented the soap opera concept, they're the ones that have been in TV production for decades, and they've actually lost some of their production lately because one of their soaps was canceled this year. So it makes sense for them to want to move into new production areas like made for TV movies. Obviously, for Walmart, a little different. But I can understand them wanting to have some sort of value-added product in the store, something you can only get at Walmart. It goes against what we talk about here all the time about making content ubiquitous, making it on demand. But maybe for certain types of movies or certain categories, maybe it makes sense for you to have to go to Walmart to get it.
So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. So we'll see how that. Tim, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, you look at who buys stuff at Walmart. It makes sense that it's family friendly,
right? It's family oriented, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of stuff they do. I mean, the money it requires to make a movie for them, especially a made for TV movie, I'm sure is it's like the electric bill for one of their stores a day.
It'd be interesting to see if they can get like Hallmark involved as well, because that feels like a really good brand fit for them.
Absolutely. We are running out of time. Brian has to get back. Tim has to get back to his stuff. Brian, where can people find you?
Twitter.com/Brian Stelter is always a good place to start.
And Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at 1 Tim Street, and I have a new podcast that's out in the iTunes store. It's SMBizz, SMBIZZ.
And what is that about?
It's about small business. So we talk with small business owners and kind of get their war stories of hiring, firing, legal issues, that kind of stuff.
So that sounds great.
It's a fun show if you're interested in small business.
You know, I gave a talk at NAB about doing production, and it was really about how to build virtual teams, but I think half of it turned into just what to do as a small video production company, and I got so much response over people. That was way more important to everybody. It was like, how do you deal with billing, and how do you deal with this? And it's all about cash flow.
That's right.
Cash flow. Anyway, thank you very much, Tim.
Great. Thanks for having me. Love being here.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for having me on.
And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.